WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we observe the National Day of Prayer and Remembrance for the victims of Katrina. We'll hear from rescuers, survivors, and a musician who's played hundreds of New Orleans funerals. Each of these people has been changed by what they experienced during and after the hurricane. Our first guest, the historian Douglas Brinkley, is already at work documenting Katrina. His book, tentatively titled The Great Deluge, is scheduled to be published early next year. Brinkley is a professor at Tulane University in New Orleans. He's created a Tulane University task force to document the catastrophe through oral histories. He's the author of the bestsellers Tour of Duty, John Kerry and the Vietnam War, and The Boys of Pointe du Hoc, Ronald Reagan, D-Day, and the U.S. Army 2nd Ranger Battalion. I asked Brinkley why he's already writing a history of Katrina.
And I'm very determined to make sure, as a historian and somebody who loves New Orleans, it's my home, I teach at Tulane University, that we don't forget what happened, that we learn why this is not just a catastrophe, but it's a deluge, and that I want to make sure that we get the oral history testimonies, talk to as many evacuees as possible, talk to as many state, local, federal officials, try to get to the bottom of it. And while the media has been, I think, very good and are generating daily great stories, I want to use all of those as primary source material, but also develop my own oral history project where over a period of a couple years, I plan to get the voices of 2,000, 3,000 additional people just for my own Tulane project.
So what's the process you're putting into effect to get the history of what happened?
Well, the first thing is to communicate, which is what didn't happen. I was in New Orleans for Katrina and then got out of town afterwards, and I came back, and I was constantly encountered people on dry land, mainly FEMA people, trying to stop rescue attempts of people that were desperate for help, and that startled me that this could happen in our country. I understand politics, and I understand that sometimes we can debate something like the war in Iraq, but this seems so basic. People are flooded. They're screaming for help. Get a boat and go get them. Yet people that had the means to save a lot of people weren't doing it. And I recognized at that point that something Dwight Eisenhower had said when he was general after World War II and encountered the concentration camps in Europe. And he said, immediately, I want it completely documented by photograph, film, interviews, everything, because if our government can turn their backs at these people in need, they will try to whitewash what happened and make it seem like it was God's storm and there was not that much that could have been done. And I think it's the story's much bigger than that.
You say you saw FEMA representatives preventing people from rescuing people?
Yes. First off, they would stop trucks in Baton Rouge that they didn't have on their clipboard. And if you were a private sector truck trying to bring in supplies, you were just completely derailed. Secondly, in New Orleans at St. Charles near Manali's restaurant, there were groups of federal officials who didn't want to get a wrinkle in their clothes, who stood by when virtually people, including schizophrenics, people with diabetes, elderly people with arthritis, were having to be saved by common citizens in fishing boats who would bring them to dry land. We'd put them on the shore, and then the government officials would just let them sit there, and they'd tell you, well, we're going to get them to a hospital. I didn't trust them, and so I would circle back, and 4 or 5 hours later, these people that were in desperate pain with nothing are still sitting on a street curb after they were pulled out of the water, nobody there to help them, yet they're surrounded by a sea of government officials. You know, part of it seemed to be a resentment that these people had stayed in New Orleans. The feeling was you had a warning to get out. Why did 100,000 of you stay?
Why did you decide to become like a freelance rescuer during a hurricane?
I came back to Houston, set my family up in an apartment, and you start watching on television, listening to radio, and you start thinking, my gosh, this is my city, and I'm just kind of sitting here in some air-conditioned, high-rise Houston hotel, and there must be something I can do. And so I went back and just wanted to connect with some friends I knew, and I had a lot of addresses of people to go check on. somebody who was missing a mother who had Alzheimer's, who was in this apartment and it was flooded. And I did some of that. Then I met a fellow named Reverend Willie Walker, who has a Noah's Ark church. And he told me that there were loads of children trapped in a building and he needed a boat. And with a couple friends of mine, we went and found a kind of primitive but useful fishing boat and went out. And sure enough, we just started pulling people in. Many of the people that stayed that I encountered in this, and you know, you'd have to take the boat in this thick, toxic muck we keep hearing about, and you'd get there. Many of them stayed because they were too ill to go. They were living on pension checks. They couldn't leave their apartment. They were elderly and by themselves. Some had mental disabilities and weren't really loved by anybody and were kind of the leftovers. There were some people with a drug addiction problem, AIDS people we encountered. It was a group of the downtrodden, if you'd like, or what Michael Harrington, you know, would call the other America, the kind of people we don't see a lot or hear a lot about. But they were there in mass, hadn't left, and were frightened to death. And so we did the best we could to start bringing them back. It would have been a normal reaction for anybody that was there on the spot because, you know, it wasn't a time to think about your own safety or what. You just knew that people were in dire straits, so you kind of just lended a hand.
What are you mourning most about the city now? What are you afraid you're going to miss most? Afraid that will never be the same about the city?
Well, the good news is the French Quarter, Warehouse District, Garden District, and Uptown is going to survive. They didn't get too much of the flooding damage. You're going to fix some windows, clear some trees, get electricity and water running, and the historic New Orleans will be back in business. But it's these side neighborhoods and communities, the near where the levees broke along Lake Pontchartrain, that I just believe are going to be devastated. Any wooden house, which was part of the charm of New Orleans, were these great wooden shotgun homes and these kind of ramshackled Victorians, and they've all been devastated. They're going to be bulldozed down, and I kind of will miss that, seeing those neighborhoods, because I'm afraid what will come in are these prefab townhouses, and it'll kind of start looking like suburbia instead of this kind of rich subtropical Afro-Caribbean center, which I love so much.
How long have you lived in New Orleans?
I've been there now since 1992. So I, you know, and it's been, it's my adopted home. My wife's born and raised there and her family is. And so now I'm an expat in Houston and my whole wife's family's with us. But I first fell in love with New Orleans because of the folklore of it. You'd hear stories about it. And as a historian, I was always very interested in the lore of the Mississippi and New Orleans. And when I first went there as a boy with my mother and father, I just was just taken with it, as some people are. So for me, it's my Paris and London and Venice and Amsterdam all rolled into one. And that's so much, I'm somebody who loves poetry and literature. And I mean, anywhere you walk there, it's where John Dos Passos wrote Manhattan Transfer. Walt Whitman worked there here at this location as a editor. Or this is where Tennessee Williams wrote Streetcar Named Desire. And Truman Capote was born here. And this is the house William Faulkner wrote his first book. And it goes on and on. And yet it's not a plaqued city. It's not. There's so much literary and musical history that kind of gets forgotten. You can walk to these historic sites in other cities. There'd be a big marker there. But in New Orleans, it's just kind of part of the Big Easy history life. And that's always fascinated me a great deal. It's still, to me, due to the music and the culture and the food, I mean, it's just a magical kind of place. To think of America without it gives me a kind of a vision of a homogenized America.
You know, having gone through the hurricane, having gone back to help rescue people, and now starting a history project documenting what happened, I'm wondering how all of that has affected your sense of identity as an American, your sense of being part of a city, a state, and a country.
I'm very disappointed in my country. You know, I write American history for a living. I love America, and as a boy, I spent my summers. My parents were teachers, and we had a trailer, and we traveled the country, and I live for this country. I mean, I am a great patriot, but I feel that our government, particularly the federal government, but also the state government in Louisiana, let us down. Don't want to see that happen. When you love your country, you have to raise your voice in dissent when you see something wrong. But what surprised me about myself is what an identity I have to New Orleans. I've been living there. I first taught at University of New Orleans, now Tulane University. It's where my life revolves around. But I realized just how many friends I have there, and like we're all here together. And normally when I hear of a hurricane, I'd say, get out. Like I leave, you know, I can go other places. I know people. I can move to California or New York. And I'm haunted. I'm kind of like driven back to New Orleans. And I realized that's what home is. It's a place you love so much. And your attachments are so deeply rooted to the landscape in a way that it's not for some people a simple matter of being pragmatic and going elsewhere.
As you begin work on your project documenting Hurricane Katrina, is there a historical incident of the past that you've been thinking about a lot?
Well, like a lot of people, we're suddenly doing quick history lessons on things like the Galveston hurricane of 1900, which killed over 8,000 people. But the Galveston's interesting because what got rebuilt was Houston out of it. And Galveston stayed a port city. It's a historic city. People live there. But the industrial thrust of the commerce moved to Houston a little bit from the Gulf of Mexico. And I think you might see that with New Orleans, where Baton Rouge, which was 250,000 people, is now about 500. It's the biggest city overnight. But also things like the San Francisco earthquake or the Great Chicago Fire, the Johnstown flood, it does make you and make journalists look back at some of those and realize that communities can spring back. I would argue San Francisco is probably the most beautiful and efficient cityscape in America today. And it certainly wasn't that after the earthquake when you look at the photographs and hear the stories. So I think the history in this way reminds us that our times are not uniquely oppressive, and that as bad as it seems in New Orleans and the Gulf region, we can spring back and will spring back, and history is a good guide for that.
So you were in New Orleans throughout the whole hurricane?
Yes, I was. I did a vertical evacuation to the 15th floor of a building known as One River Place. The reason we did that was my father-in-law was the architect of the building, and it was built after Hurricane Camille in 1969. So it was supposedly a hurricane-proof building. And I do have to say it did survive in very good shape, except I was on the top floor and some of the balconies started blowing off. The generator that was supposed to be there for the building didn't work, so we had to sit in the lobby with a lot of other people that stayed. But I was very blessed that this building was along the river and not along Lake Pontchartrain, and that it was very well designed architecturally to survive a storm of this magnitude. Very few buildings in New Orleans are.
Well, while you were in New Orleans during the hurricane in this high-rise that you had evacuated to, what is the most amazing part of the hurricane that you witnessed?
Well, there's, you know, I'm a great lover of the Mississippi River, and Mark Twain once said, you know, no sense ever studying the river because it changes its course every week, meaning it's a hard river to map. Of course, the Army Corps of Engineers, after the Great Flood of 1927, has built up the levee system. But sitting on top of on the balcony of a high rise right on the river, I saw the Mississippi run backwards. I never thought I'd live to see such a thing. The wrath of the storm was white capping the river, and all that water from the Gulf was flowing up river instead of down. And so it was a menacing, horrific sight, which is etched in my memory forever. And it was, it's hard to believe a river as large and powerful and potent as the Mississippi could turn on its heels and run backwards. But that's what it did.
Doug Brinkley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Terry.
Douglas Brinkley is a professor of history at Tulane University and is writing a book about Katrina, scheduled for publication early next year.